What's cooking? And welcome to Hidden Behind the Music Stand. I'm your host, Patty Ryan, and with me is Brendan Fitzgerald. Brendan. Right, exactly. Who is a section bassist of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, and we'll be talking about cooking that sweet, sweet barbecue. Welcome, Brendan. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, so it's funny because I feel like we should have met, we maybe did meet, like a long time ago, because you are also a native San Diegan.
Oh, I did not know you're from San Diego.
Yeah, I went to SDYS and like did a whole thing there, you know what I mean? Like, so we should have, I feel like we must have overlapped, but I don't know. I'm just a stereotypical cellist. I didn't talk to the bassist because they're not my line of view, you know?
I left a little early to go to Interlaken for my senior year. And so I also joined the youth orchestra in like my sophomore year of high school. I started playing bass pretty late. So
yeah,
a very narrow window of classical music in San Diego for me.
Yeah. I mean, Jeff Edmonds was still the conductor there, right?
Very much so.
So I still experienced Jeff Edmonds. Shout out, I guess. But honestly, it's funny that we started at the same place, but then didn't go to any of the same schools. And we've only met because of your fiance, future wife, Autumn Chodorowski, who's also past guest of this podcast as well.
Mm-hmm. And even, I think you guys met in San Francisco, right?
Well, we met at Tanglewood first, but we really got to know each other when she joined the program, the artistic degree or whatever, and chamber music.
Yeah, artist diploma, something. Yeah.
Some other.
And even, you know, out there, we were dating then and I visited her a few times and you and I never met until I think we met when I drove through Minnesota when I was moving from Seattle to St. Louis a couple years ago.
Yes, that's right. Before COVID. Hanging out with Eric Riffle, also past guest of the podcast.
That's right.
Yeah. Everything's all connected, but it's just funny how it's like, it took us so long. But regardless, that's why I always am like, oh, I wonder when you guys are going to visit San Diego because we can always like hang out like for Christmas or something like that.
Yeah. And you know, we tried to basically, when Autumn moved here, we said, all right, we're going to go to San Diego like two or three times a year because it's a great place to visit. I've got, you know, a home there. And then obviously COVID. So we're still kind of slowly ramping up our San Diego visits.
Yeah.
Make sure to stock up on burritos and go there. And
yes.
Visit the beach, even if it's freezing cold. You know, just gotta get our fill before we come back to the frigid wasteland of the Midwest.
Totally. Since you're also a San Diegan, can you confirm with me that the best Mexican food is in San Diego only?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Well, outside of Mexico.
Well, maybe, right. I mean, in the United States.
Absolutely. People in San Francisco and LA try to claim that theirs is the best, but that's nonsense.
I agree.
San Diego, it's just the closest. Actually, when I was there with Autumn recently, we were taking a hike and, you know, we were up on some hills and I pointed and said, look, there's Mexico. Like, you can literally see the hills of Tijuana from anywhere in San Diego.
On a mountain in San Diego, yeah. I know, it's wild to think that it's like so close.
Of course, I'm biased, but I think our burrito style is better than the San Francisco Mission burritos as well.
Yeah.
Because San Diego burritos, it's basically just meat and maybe French fries or guacamole and pico de gallo and stuff. And then you get rice and beans on the side if you want it. But in San Francisco, the burrito is like the size of your arm and 3/4 of it is filler, rice and beans.
Yeah.
That said, I really do like the Mission burritos. They're still really good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for, I feel like that's something that's just, it's been on my chest for a really long time. Needed to get it off.
You're right. So this is a safe space.
Thank you. And it's also like, we're talking about barbecue. So it's like all appropriate. Anyway.
Grilled meats.
Yeah. So Brendan, what's your most insane performance story?
Well, it was a long time ago.
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Before you said that there's 1.5 stories.
So I'll start with the half just because it's short. Playing the St. Louis Symphony, maybe about 2 years ago, we had Ben Folds come and do a concert with us. And he has this shtick. He does a bunch of stuff. And one of the things was, he's got this crazy story from Chicago where someone basically shouted out at the end of a concert that was being recorded for a live album. They shouted out, "Rock this bitch," and it stayed on the album.
Okay.
And so now at every one of his concerts, someone from the audience shouts that out.
Yeah.
Or multiple people from the audience shout that out during some silence. And so basically it was just a very surreal experience being in Powell Hall, where we're normally performing these great, you know, 17th, 18th century masterworks.
Right.
and hearing 2,800 people shout, "Rock this bitch," over and over again for like 5 minutes. I mean, it was just, it's not what you typically hear in an orchestral concert hall.
No, definitely not. Yeah.
So that's, I guess, an insane performance story. But the one that's really, it's still just kind of burned in my brain, is when I was at Interlochen Arts Academy for my senior year of high school, they do a collage performance every year where they feature all the different arts disciplines during Parents Week. So all the parents are visiting and they do one like 2-hour concert with no intermission where they feature all the, you know, like I said, all the arts disciplines. So I think they had visual artists lined up along the sides, painting on, you know, easels or, you know, using whatever their, you know, visual medium is, or sculpting. While the concert's going on, the dancers do something. Theater kids do like a musical theater review, a bunch of show tunes. They basically feature, you know, every discipline, and it's really seamlessly choreographed so that they have multiple curtains. And so one performance ends and then like a curtain rises and the next performance begins immediately.
Wow. Okay.
And so they kind of are moving up and down stage to just keep the flow of this concert going. And the final thing on the performance was the orchestra playing Barber's Second Essay. And so we were all in our chairs, like warmed up, ready to go. And the conductor was supposed to be on the podium, and then the curtain rises and we play. And we had already done this in, I think, maybe 2 dress rehearsals and 1 concert. And then in the second concert of the weekend, we're getting ready to go and all the, you know, orchestra's there, and we look up and the podium's empty. We're all kind of scratching our heads, and we start hearing the music from, I don't remember if it was the guitars or whatever was happening right before the orchestra. We kind of knew what was going on right before the curtain rose for us. And so we start hearing that. We're like, wait, we're on in like a minute.
Yeah.
We're on in like 30 seconds. Like, it's like 10 seconds and we're going, and the conductor's still not there.
Oh.
And so then they finish their thing and the curtain rises and there's no conductor on the podium. And this is a bunch of, you know, high school kids. And we all kind of like look around for a second, you know, quaking in our boots. And then the concertmaster just kind of looks up and goes, and gives a gesture. And then we all played Barber's Second Essay.
Without conductor.
Without a conductor. And it was like the most electrifying, exciting performance ever. And I mean, the funny thing about it is that the audience had no idea. They thought that that was what was supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And so then afterwards, when everyone goes and meets their parents, they're like, we were supposed to have a conductor. I don't know. It was just wild.
Wow, so, what happened? Do you know what happened to the conductor?
He just thought, so it was a matinee performance, and I think he thought it was an evening performance. He was actually sitting in his office, like, I don't know.
Twiddling his thumbs.
Yeah, like probably a 2-minute walk from the auditorium, and he was just sitting in his office, you know, I don't know, studying scores or
working on
the Boeings for the next concert cycle or something. And someone like stormed it, you know, busted into his office midway through the performance and was like, your orchestra's playing right now.
Yeah.
And he's like, no! No! Oh my gosh, no! I mean, he's a very nice guy, really wonderful, wonderful conductor, and, you know, really inspiring musician. It was just an honest mistake, and, you know, we stepped up to the challenge.
Yeah, totally. What a weird experience. I mean, also kind of badass in a way to be like, we don't need you.
Yeah, that's where I first learned how little the conductor actually does.
Oh, no!
But no. That's a joke.
I know. We're all joking here, yeah. Oh my gosh. Wow. That's awesome. The whole time, were you just like quaking in your boots kind of thing? Or was it like, okay, here, this is really awesome?
Yeah. Super, super nervous. But also, I mean, it was the type of nervousness where, I mean, we were all kind of experiencing that electrifying, fearful energy together. And so we were all there, you know, like there were maybe little mistakes and, you know, the transitions between different tempos that the conductor would have helped us with. But we knew that, like, we're performing this for the first time without a conductor as a bunch of teenagers. This is great. You know, we were all just having a lot of fun playing together. I mean, it was very freeing. You know, you have those musical performances where you don't feel like there's a traffic cop up front making sure that everything is in its little box.
Sure.
And we all just were able to, you know, let it rip.
Yeah. That's really awesome. Thanks for sharing that story. And I hope that never happens to you again, I guess.
Well, now it would be a lot less scary. I mean,
that's true.
In a professional orchestra, the conductor's there to help guide and shape the musical expression and lead rehearsals. But I mean, sometimes they'll start conducting and then walk out into the hall and listen, and the orchestra keeps playing.
Right. So right.
it wouldn't be nearly as scary now. It would all, I mean, it would still be super fun, but back then, I mean, it was terrifying. And especially because there was no discussion, you know, we couldn't like huddle up and go, all right, guys, here's what we're going to do.
Right.
Where you start it and then we're going to lead this and I'm going to lead, you know, like stuff you do in chamber music
right.
where it's all planned. It was just, there was no plan.
Like, go!
Yeah, exactly. It was good. We were all kind of looking around like, what's going to happen? And then the concertmaster just gave a really big gesture that we all knew, okay, we're starting. And we all started and played the last note together. Yeah, we finished together.
Right? Yeah.
I think it's on YouTube. I think there might be like a bootleg that some parent took of part of the performance. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be interesting to watch.
I'll have to find it. I'll try to find it and send you the link.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Well, are you ready for some spitfire questions?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mahler or Bruckner?
Mahler.
Debussy or Ravel?
Debussy.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Appetizer or dessert?
Appetizer.
Okay.
I had to think about that one.
What was the dessert that was tempting you to say dessert?
Oh, all of them.
Okay. Fair enough. Sparkling or still water?
Sparkling.
Fan favorite question, alternate universe musical instrument?
Oh, the bass.
You can't do that.
Bassoon.
Okay. Why bassoon? The register?
Well, they play a lot of bass lines, yeah. Okay. So it's a similar, just that fat, deep tone. And there's a really kind of spicy character about the bassoon that I really like. I try to actually sometimes with the bass think about like, how would the bassoon play this? What type of sound are they making?
Mm-hmm.
And get that really kind of snarky character.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah. I feel like that's why Shostakovich, for instance, uses the bassoon in such a way. Like, to me, it just, his music and his bassoon writing is just like so perfect.
Mm-hmm.
To get, as you say, that snarky character.
Yeah, really like sarcastic and sardonic wit that he has.
Yeah, totally. Early bird or night owl?
Night owl.
Okay. Pandemic guilty pleasure?
Barbecue.
I knew you were going to say that. I was like, I bet it's barbecue. All right, we'll talk about that further. Favorite professor shout out?
Oh, my bass teacher at Northwestern University, Andy Rossidi, 100%. He was, I mean, just the most unbelievable musical influence and kind of father figure and mentor. And my start at Northwestern was a little rocky. There was some turnover in the bass faculty and I was kind of lost. And I started bass so late that I didn't have a really firm foundation to grow on. And he came in my junior year and just really kind of turned me around. And I owe everything that I've done to him.
Aw, that's so sweet. But yeah.
Yeah, he's such a wonderful person. You talk to anyone who knows the guy and they say, wow, Andy's the best, you know.
Yeah. Most inspired musical hero of any genre?
Oh, I know these are spitfire questions, but that I need to think about for a second. I guess, you know, it changes so often, but I would say right now and for the last few years, Augustin Hadelijk.
Yes. Oh my gosh, totally. I feel like he's our savior in some way. Like, you know, like musically, I know this is supposed to be your answer, but like I constantly watch his performance of Brahms' second violin sonata, the A major one that he did at Tanglewood.
Mm-hmm.
It's on YouTube.
Oh, with Ryan Weiss?
Yes. It's like the best collaborative performance of that sonata I've ever heard. And it's like, thank God it's on YouTube because I can watch it all the time, which is what I do. So.
Yeah, his sound is just addicting.
Totally.
It's so beautiful and pristine and gorgeous, and he's just so unbelievably committed to the music all the time. Yeah, and you meet him in person and he's just a totally like humble, down-to-earth guy who's just up there having fun playing music, which is, you know, it's what
the
I try to do, and that's what all of us want to do, you know, just want to have fun playing music, and if we get paid for it, sweet.
Yeah.
And he just really carries that energy around with everything he does, and yeah, absolute hero. We're actually playing Barber's violin concerto with him next week here in St. Louis.
Oh, I'm so jealous. That's so jealous. That's also one of my favorite violin concertos too. I bet he plays the pants off that last movement.
We'll see. I'm sure he will. I can't imagine him doing anything else. That's actually Autumn's favorite violin concerto.
Oh, really? Well, we're soul sisters, I guess. But anyway. Most transformative performance experience?
Well, I like to think that everyone is. It's really hard to... Okay, actually, you know, I do have one. My first time playing with a full-time professional orchestra was with the Milwaukee Symphony, where my teacher, Andy, was acting principal at the time, and he called me into sub. It was before I had officially gotten on the sub list. I actually played my sub list audition the morning after these concerts that I was going to talk about. But it was Nielsen's Fifth Symphony, which is famously, fiendishly difficult. And I spent, you know, months and months preparing. You know, I didn't want to come in and just be kind of showing up and dogging it, you know, especially because I wasn't officially on the list. You know, my teacher invited me in. I didn't want to have anyone claim that there was nepotism at work. And it was, I mean, the hardest thing I had ever played in the best orchestra that I had ever played with at the time. And it was just so, so fun. Just a, like a totally rip-roaring performance. And yeah, it was like, kind of like my debut. You know, everyone has their Carnegie Hall, or not everyone, but a lot of chamber musicians and soloists, they have their Carnegie Hall debut, even if they've already been soloing. You know, I had been playing with the Kalamazoo Symphony for years and was playing in the Civic Orchestra and had been to a few festivals. But this was my first time playing, kind of made it to the big leagues, as they say.
Or like playing with your mentors. It's like when your mentor becomes your equal in a section kind of feeling, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we became colleagues and friends instead of just teacher and student.
That's right. Awesome.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah. Desert island piece of any genre?
Well, it's a specific album or collection of albums, the complete Concerti Grossi by Arcangelo Corelli, performed by Amandine Beyer and her group Glee Incogniti.
Wow. Okay. That came out of left field for me. Do you say why?
Well, I really love historical performance and, you know, period groups, that type of thing. And this one, I mean, just the colors, the virtuosity and expressivity, the life that they bring to the music. I mean, it's unbelievable. If you look at the score or look at, you know, just the violin part and then listen to what they're doing, I mean, it's like looking at a jazz chart and just seeing the melody and the chords, and then you hear a great combo or big band or something put it together, and you just think, how are they doing this? You know, how are they playing so together and creating these nuances and gestures when none of it is on the page? It's just, you know, quarter notes and half notes. It's just, it's incredible.
Yeah.
I think in another, okay, you know what? I'm going to change my answer.
What?
In another, no, not for that. For in another life, what instrument would I be?
Oh, okay. Okay.
I would be a Baroque gamba player.
Okay, fair enough. Interesting, though. Yeah, like...
And there's still time. I could still buy a gamba and, you know, slap gut strings on my bass and become a period performer.
But that's true.
I love that stuff.
But
maybe, you know,
also...
it's a similar...
Yeah, I was going to say, there's like a similar nasally, but I don't know if it's nasal. I see, nasal always sounds like a bad term in music, but it's not.
But it's, yeah, there's a little more, maybe a little more grit, a little more color in the sound. Yeah. Sounds more earthy. Yeah, I love that stuff. And it, like bassoon, you know, it's got that kind of snarky character. I feel like the Baroque strings often all have that snarky character, like a really hard percussive articulation sometimes. And it's incredible. I love what all the Baroque crispy. That's a good word for it. Super crispy.
Nice. Okay, you finished the Spitfire questions. Congratulations. Oh, are you doing it up top?
Amazing.
Oh, okay.
Amazing.
Never mind.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Brendan, can you walk me through your musical origin story? How did you discover the bass? When did you decide this is what you want to do in life? And all the schooling and steps along the way to land you in the section of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra?
Yes, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Yeah, well, maybe not a galaxy
far, far away. As in San Diego, California.
San Diego, California. Yeah, does sometimes feel like another galaxy from
the Midwest.
Eastern Missouri. Yeah, so I started, I think my parents started me on piano when I was 6 or 7 or something. And I took piano lessons and gave little, you know, recitals at the local church. Not recitals on my own, but studio recitals where I'd play one piece and bow and everyone applauds and then you get snacks afterwards. So I started on piano and then I switched to trumpet, I believe in 4th grade. My dad is actually a trumpet player. He went to Rice when the Shepherd School was first getting started.
Whoa.
And then ended up getting a law degree later. So he's a professional lawyer, but he keeps his trumpet chops up. He's subbed in the San Diego Symphony, and he performed in, I think it was the Dallas Symphony's performance of Mahler 8 a few years ago. And,
oh, cool.
So he still plays, and he still schmoozes with a lot of brass players and tries to kind of keep one foot in the orchestral music world. Meanwhile, he's not
making
a musician
tons of money.
By
I don't
trade.
Know. Maybe not. Sorry.
He is making tons. That's right. It's true. it's very nice for me. You know, I was able to help with school and, you know, buying my bass and taking auditions and stuff.
I didn't mean to put a pressure point on that, but sorry.
No, it's absolutely true. People who have to apply for every conceivable scholarship and grant and take out huge loans to fund their instruments and school. I mean, that stuff is really tough. And I was unbelievably fortunate to not have to do a lot of that. Anyway, so he played trumpet and I started studying with him a little. And then we had some lesson where I actually talked to him about this recently. Basically, he was trying to get me to hit some note and I couldn't. And I was getting tired and frustrated. And he was saying, just blow, use more air. And I didn't really get what he was saying. And I started crying. And he said, all right, we're done. And then moved me to another I got a teacher who was not my parent, which I'm very thankful for. Kept playing trumpet in the San Diego Youth Wind Ensemble and then played in middle school band. And then it was in eighth grade where I was in the middle school band and there were three electric bass players sitting, you know, in the back of the band. And they were like the Three Stooges, just super tight friends and really, really funny. I mean, always cracking jokes and having a good time back there. And so whenever I could sneak out of my chair to go hang out with them, I would. And then one of them, you know, put their bass in my, I was like, can I try that? And they said, yeah, sure. And I was listening to a lot of Blink-182 and started listening to Red Hot Chili Peppers. And
yeah.
That's right. Yeah. You know, the natives. Yeah. And so, you know, I was interested in kind of being a rock bassist or something or a rock guitarist and, you know, started playing their bass. And I told my dad I wanted to play guitar. And he said, well, everyone plays guitar and every band needs a bassist. So
that's true.
You can play bass.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, fine. So got an electric bass, started taking lessons with a really great jazz teacher in town. And at some point, maybe after a year or two of studying with him, he said, and I don't totally agree with this, but is an important quote for me to hear. He said, everything that can be done on electric bass has been done. So you need to get an upright bass to find your own musical voice. And while you're at it, get a bow just so that you have one. And so then I got an upright bass and a bow and started studying with a guy in the symphony as well. And I wasn't taking it super seriously. I mean, I was going to youth orchestra and I was playing in acoustic folk rock trio. It was upright bass and harp and mandolin and three-part vocal harmonies. We were covering like Nickel Creek and the Postal Service and stuff, you know, just a bunch of kind of indie
bands
rock
of the time,
stuff.
Yeah.
And then I went to Interlochen Summer Arts Camp in 2008 and realized that, you know, there was this whole other world of serious orchestral tradition out there. And it was, I mean, I was by far the worst one there. I got in off the wait list and was really, you know, at the bottom of the pack. I wasn't taking it very seriously. And everybody else had already been playing for 8-10 years. I had been playing for 1 or 2. And so, you know, I wasn't being hard on myself or down on myself. I just realized, well, they've been doing this longer. They've been taking it really seriously for longer. I'll get there if I keep working. And so I decided to go to the academy. So I spent my senior year there, at which point I applied to colleges and then went to Northwestern, where I then met Andy Ricciti after he was appointed to the faculty a couple of years later. I won an audition for the Kalamazoo Symphony. It was the beginning of my junior year and started driving 3 hours out and 3 hours back 5 days in a row, maybe once a month or so, to play with the Kalamazoo Symphony while I was in school. Yeah, I see the face you're making, and that's exactly how it felt. Driving 30 hours a week, getting back at, you know, midnight. And
that does not sound fun.
But I got a ton of experience. I got to play with a really great orchestra and just advance my chops and start to learn the repertoire more. And then I joined the Civic Orchestra of Chicago when I finished at Northwestern. Did that for 2 years. Meanwhile, I was taking auditions and starting to do pretty well. I was making some finals here and there and advancing most of the time. And then I won a one-year position in the Seattle Symphony, which was then extended another year. So I spent 2 years playing there.
What did it feel like to win that?
I mean, it was just this unbelievable sigh of relief. The timing couldn't have been better. I was about to turn 26, and so I was about to be removed from my parents' health insurance.
Oh my God, that's right.
My 2 year Civic is a 2 year program, and my 2 years were up. So I was about to be, you know, living the freelance hustle life, which is fine. I mean, a lot of people do it and are very happy doing it. But I would have been, you know, driving to and from Milwaukee constantly, trying to get out to Michigan, play out there, pick up every gig I could in Chicago, and still try to take auditions, which is really tough. Yeah, and so I got this gig at the perfect time, packed up all my stuff, moved to Seattle, and spent 2 years there where I lived in an apartment downtown within walking distance from the hall. I was able to leave my bass at the hall and practice there. And so I wasn't a hermit necessarily. I mean, I had a social life out there, but I had all the time in the world to practice and take auditions as much as I wanted. You know, I was making a steady income. I had a place where I could key myself into the hall at 2-3 a.m. and do a late night session only once or twice with 2 or 3 a.m. But I did practice after concerts quite a bit. If I wasn't done, you know, when I was in leading up to the St. Louis Symphony audition, if I hadn't really finished what I needed to do that day, I would need to save something for the concert. You can't play a concert when you're just totally exhausted. Right. Yeah, I mean, first of all, it wouldn't be, you know, I'm getting paid to play my best, and so I wouldn't be doing that. And also, I mean, you could get injured. If you work harder than your body and mind will allow, the classical music industry is rife with performance injuries.
Totally.
And so I was careful to not fall into that. So anyway, I would, you know, save something. And then sometimes after performances, instead of having a beer with the bass section or going out with, you know, other members of the orchestra and, you know, eating some food or whatever, I would say, I'm sorry, I need to go practice. And so I'd find one of the practice rooms and put in another hour or two. Anyway, so just, I mean, really the last 3 or 4 months before I won the audition that I did, I was probably playing bass 8 hours a day. I was working the full schedule. 8 service weeks are really common out there. And then in addition to that, practicing 4 or 5 hours a day. What I did do during that time, which I think is like, I tell everyone to do this or at least consider it, is I took a day off every week. Mm-hmm. Monday is the orchestra day off, and I did not play bass. I did not pick up my bass. I did not think about music aside from, you know, listening to something that I enjoy. I really relaxed on Mondays, every Monday, and it saved my hands and my back. And also, I think it just kept me mentally fresh. You know, when I went into practice on Tuesdays, I was itching to go. Especially there were times when I wanted to practice on Monday. I felt like, oh, if I get a couple, you know, run-throughs on this piece, or maybe if I play a mock audition for someone, or take this gig. I mean, a lot of gigs are offered on Mondays, like recording stuff outside the symphony out there. And I would say no to all of them.
Wow.
Because I said, nope, Monday's my day off.
Wow,
I
you were really strict about it.
Extremely. Wow. Yeah. And it helped. And ultimately, it worked. I came and auditioned for the St. Louis Symphony in May of 2019 and won the job. They gave me and another guy trials for associate principal, which he got. I mean, absolutely deserves. He's a wonderful, wonderful musician, humble guy, and couldn't be happier for him. He's so, so fun to play with. I actually had him over last night for ribs and game night.
Oh, nice.
Alec Belcher is his name. He's a really wonderful, warm-hearted dude. Anyway, so the two of us joined the symphony in the fall of 2019, where we played about a half season before COVID. Yeah. Anyway, I've been here since then and loving it. I mean, it's an incredible orchestra. The hall, acoustically, I think it might be one of the best on the planet. And the guest conductors we bring in and the soloists, I mean, we got Augustin Hadelik coming next week. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't be any luckier. You know, it's hard to imagine myself happier. I get to play just the greatest orchestral masterworks in human tradition on a weekly basis with a bunch of incredible colleagues. So I think that about sums up
sounds
my
like
path
a success story. Yeah.
Starting music to where I am now.
Yeah, I think it's so fascinating that what gravitated you towards the bass in general was more of the personality of the people, or like the people that would gravitate towards a certain instrument. You know what I mean? Like,
it was that sense of camaraderie and community that really exists in the bass world. I mean,
it's
a very small world. Yeah, it's, you know, anyone who's been in an orchestra or at a summer festival, they'll see, you know, just gangs of bassists roaming around together. It's a really tight-knit community.
Talking about rosin and talking about, like, I don't know what other stereotypes there are, but just like, yeah, always talking, oh, like, where are the basses? Like, every bassist knows everyone else's bass or something, or the origin of where they came from and things like that, right?
Yep. It's just, it's a really small world and it's filled with a lot of geeks, which is great. I'm proud to call myself one of those geeks.
Sure. Yeah. I was wondering about, like, why did you ditch the trumpet? Because you could have kept playing trumpet.
Yeah, I wasn't in love with it.
And piano, too, I guess.
Yeah, well, piano, I mean, that was, you know, my parents had me do that before I knew what was going. You know, they had me play every sport that I, you know, they just kind of say, play t-ball, whatever, play soccer, play football, play tennis. I did get pretty good at tennis and really enjoyed that. And I still play.
With Andrew, right? Past guest.
Yeah, play with Andrew Francois. And I play with my principal bass, Eric Harris, and horn player on our orchestra. Actually, when I was up in Minnesota doing a trial up there for a position, I played tennis with the principal cello, Tony Ross.
Oh, Tony. Okay.
Absolutely destroyed me. I think we just played once, but it was a sound beating.
Oh.
Yeah. It was fun though. It was good.
Yeah. Sorry, but why did you stop playing trumpet?
Oh, yeah. That was the question. I just didn't really like practicing that much. And also I got braces and then.
That
was actually okay. I was able to adjust to that. But then when I got the braces off, it really set me back a lot. And I just didn't have the patience to figure out how to do it again. Yeah, it seems like it would go the opposite way. I mean, there was a learning curve with the braces, figuring out how to play and, you know, not use as much pressure with the mouthpiece. But then once you're the inside of your lips kind of, I don't know if it's like a callus or whatever happens in there. But once I got used to it after a few months, I was back to kind of playing at the level that I already was. But then when the braces came off, something was just different. And at that point, I was already playing in one or two different rock bands, garage bands with my friends in Coronado, and was starting to play, you know, jazz as an upright bassist, and was playing in this folk rock trio. And so I had a lot of other musical irons in the fire. And it just wasn't a love connection with the trumpet anymore.
Was your dad let down by the fact that you stopped playing trumpet?
Oh, no. I mean, maybe a tiny bit, but then the fact that I made it into a professional symphony orchestra, I mean, he was like almost happier than me. I mean, when I called him to tell him I won the job, he just started shouting and crying, and yeah, it was great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's just like a proud dad moment too. Yeah. And that's awesome too.
Yeah.
Like a goal that he had or wanted for himself as well. But
had for himself. And like I said, you know, he keeps in really close touch with a lot of members of the orchestral brass community. So he knows just how unbelievably competitive the music industry is, auditions in particular. And so for me to win one, he was just over the moon and still is. He came out to Seattle and saw my performances there. He flew out to Milwaukee, that first concert that I played with them, doing Nielsen 5. He's come out and heard the St. Louis Symphony, and every time he comes backstage afterwards and you see tears in his eyes, he's wearing this tie that he had made my senior year of high school that has like my senior picture plastered all over it. It's the most dorky and embarrassing thing ever, but it's good.
It's also like a weird reminder of like where you came from, like on that tie.
Yeah, well, especially because back then, I mean, the haircut that I had, it was in San Diego.
Dated?
People call it scene, but what most people would refer to it as emo.
Sure.
I mean, the type of screamo music that I was listening to, I was styling myself in that way. And so every time he comes to a concert, even today at, you know, 30 years old, I have to see myself on that tie with the hair that, you know, falls over one eye and is
totally
in the back. And say, all right, yep, well, I don't look like that anymore, but I did once.
Yeah, right. All right, well, is this a good time to take a break?
Sure.
Okay, we'll be right back. Welcome back from the break. So, barbecue, pandemic guilty pleasure. Is that really, did you do any barbecuing before the pandemic, or really was it, that was the inspiration?
No, that was it.
Wow.
When I moved to St. Louis, I bought a grill. I bought a little Weber kettle, and then it stayed in a box in my basement for about 6 months. And then when the pandemic hit and I suddenly had all this extra time, I took it out and cranked it up and fired up the charcoal and started smoking and grilling various meats and vegetables too. You know, I don't only eat meat, but
sure.
Yeah, it was just a super fun project. I mean, it takes a lot of time. Brisket's probably the most intense barbecue thing, and it's like a 16 or 18 hour smoke. So you have to start it at like midnight and then babysit it a little bit overnight, like wake up a couple times throughout the night.
When literally
I do briskets,
like
I sleep
babysitting
on the couch. Yeah, I mean, it's you're like babysitting it, seriously. And then it's done, you know, at dinner time the next day. Ribs are a lot quicker. I mean, it's like a 5 or 6 hour thing, but still you have to kind of stay around the grill and be ready to, you know, move the vents around to mess with the temperature. And if it's a longer thing, like, you know, like I said, brisket or pork butt or something, you need to add more charcoal, add more water. You know, there's stuff that you're doing with the grill if you don't have like a nice pellet smoker or something.
Yeah. So that was going to be my my question, which I feel so stupid asking this, but what is the difference between a smoker and a grill? Is there a difference? Are there varieties that are combined? Like, it's a dual purpose.
Yeah, well, a smoker specifically is something that pretty much only brings the heat up to 300 degrees or so, and it can cook anywhere between about 200 and 300 degrees, and it burns some... There are electric smokers, there are pellet smokers, which are like little pellets of wood that feed into like an auger, and it's very automatic and ease of use. And then what I have is actually a grill that has some inserts and attachments that let me use it as a smoker. So smoking food is, you know, any sort of meat or whatever, is basically just the process of cooking it at a really low temperature for a long time and using wood smoke to help flavor the food. Mm-hmm. And so on my grill, I'll have a bunch of charcoal laid out on one side in a little basket that helps it burn more efficiently. And then I'll lay a couple chunks of wood on top of that. So as the coals burn down the line, those chunks of wood will ignite and then smolder, and that smoke bastes the meat in flavor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then a grill, I mean, the typical grill that most people have is like a propane grill, where you press a button and turn the flame on, and then you're getting direct heat. So whatever food you put on top of the burner, the flame is really close to the meat, and you're probably cooking at like 400 or 500 degrees. So it's just, it cooks things faster, but you don't have enough time to liquefy all the connective tissue that makes barbecue what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for that clarification. So when you're doing that brisket, you're mostly smoking it.
Oh yeah. Smoking it the whole time. When you cook brisket, you cook it at 225 degrees for 16 to 20 hours, depending on how big the hunk of meat is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So whenever you go to a barbecue place and you order the brisket, just know that there's been a lot of time put into that slice of meat you're eating.
And a lot of love. Yeah.
A lot of love. That's right.
I mean, I wonder how do barbecue restaurants do that? If it's literally you have to get up in the middle of the night, do you think they do this the same thing, or is it much more systemized? Or,
well, they probably start it kind of overnight. You know, they'll put it on at 8 p.m. or something, and then the brisket will finish, you know, the next day, maybe around lunchtime. Or they'll start it in the middle of the day and let it go overnight and then finish it in the morning. You can always take barbecue and hold it. So, I mean, when you go to a barbecue place and you order something, you know, they don't cook it for you then. It's already cooked. They take it out of some sort of warming rack or warming tray and they slice off a piece and, you know, hand it to you. So they kind of cook it, not days ahead of time, but they have it finished like before the store opens. But yeah, I mean, they're like, if you work at a barbecue restaurant, oftentimes you'll show up to work at 4 a.m. to put all the ribs on. So then it's ready for, you know, when the restaurant opens at 11, you've got 50, 60 racks of ribs ready to go.
Right. I never really thought about how a barbecue restaurant kind of works, you know? So that's where I'm like, oh, actually, yeah, it does take, like, they do have to do a lot of preparation before the final product, what you see on your plate. It's not like...
And have people work in the night shift.
Yeah. Okay. So I know why you started, but why was it barbecue that you got into? Like, what about, did you just like have like an itch to scratch with that, or?
Yeah, well, I mean, I love barbecue. It just, every time I eat it, I fall in love with, you know, everything that I'm eating. I took 3 auditions for the Kansas City Symphony. Time I'd be there for 2 or 3 days, and I would eat like 5 barbecue meals. When I came to St. Louis, I went to a place called Salt and Smoke, and then the next day I went to a place called Pappy's, and it was the best barbecue I had ever eaten in my life. Kansas City's great. I think St. Louis barbecue is a little bit better, but it's all fantastic. Every region has its own style of barbecue. There's Texas barbecue, there's Carolina, and Carolina actually has like Eastern and Western. There's slightly different styles with the sauces that they use. There's Kansas City style, St. Louis, Memphis, Nashville, California even has some of their own types of barbecue. And it's just regional variations on the sauce and what types of cuts of meat they use. Texas is much more beef centric. Midwest, you know, Kansas City and Memphis and whatnot, that stuff is more pork centric. Carolina is pork, but they use like a vinegar or a mustard base instead of a sweet tomato base. You know, when you think of barbecue sauce, that's a sweet tomato based sauce that originated in Kansas City. And that's what you typically get when you get barbecue in Kansas City. And you find it everywhere. But yeah, I love barbecue, and when you go and eat it somewhere, it's typically pretty expensive for, you know, one little plate of meat. And so I just wanted to be able to, I don't know, I think part of it is I just had the time. You know, I had the time to sit around and babysit a big hunk of meat for 8 hours straight. And then I started having fun cooking it. I mean, it's such a unique way of cooking. You know, you get outside, you're not in the kitchen. I could like practice my disc golf throws in the backyard and sit outside and enjoy the, you know, sunny weather. Or, I mean, I just smoked 2 racks of ribs last night and it was 15 degrees outside. And so I didn't spend much time outside. I have a remote thermometer that has like a Bluetooth type thing, so I can sit inside and see what temperature my smoker is and run outside when I need to do something to it. But so like with the brisket, I've got a, like I said, the remote thermometer where there's a probe that's sitting at grate level right next to the meat, so it's taking the air temperature, and then there's a probe inside the meat that's taking the center of the meat temperature. Basically, if the temperature gets too low or too high, there's a little alarm that goes off. So like I said, when I do brisket, I sleep on the couch because I'll be sleeping and then an hour or two, you know, into a REM cycle, I'll hear beep, 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 beep. And I have to run outside and add more charcoal or open or close a vent or something to mess with the temperature a little bit.
Yeah, that sounds like such a commitment.
It is.
Yeah.
But then the reward is totally worth it. I mean, you know, right. I had 4 people over last night for board games and ribs, and just seeing the looks on their faces as they dug into their ribs. And, you know, afterwards when they were leaving, they were saying, oh my God, those ribs were unbelievable. I was thinking like, yeah, they're pretty good. But, you know, that feeling of putting in a bunch of time and then giving it to someone. I mean, maybe that's why we're musicians, you know, like we don't perform for ourselves. I mean, I love the sound of the bass. I love the sound of an orchestra. But when we perform on stage, we're performing for the audience. And with barbecue, I mean, I guess I could smoke a 16-pound brisket and eat it all myself over the course of the next few weeks. But that's not typically how it's done. You know, normally I'll have people over and, you know, enjoy conversation and socializing and get to watch them sit back in their chairs and enjoy a great meal that they didn't have to work at.
Yeah, totally. So can we talk a little bit about the various woods that you use?
Yeah. Well, some smokers are purely wood burning. And so you feed little logs into the smoker every couple hours or 30 minutes or whatever to keep the temperature stable. I use a charcoal grill. Basically, charcoal is super compressed and previously burned wood that burns at a high temperature for a really long time. And so I've got the charcoal burning and then chunks of wood on top of that that add flavor. And I still haven't done a whole lot of experimenting with the different types. I use apple and pecan and cherry, but I haven't gotten as specific about those choices yet.
Okay, that's something that I might have to do at some point. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as I do this more, I've only been doing it for, you know, a year or so. I'll start differentiating the wood I use. You know, maybe I'll make ribs with a cherry wood and then the next time do it with apple and see how it changes the flavor.
But you can't necessarily flavor. Yeah, you can't necessarily tell that difference yet.
Not yet.
Okay.
No. Or I mean, maybe I could if I had them side by side. But the other thing is I only have one smoker.
Yeah.
And whatever smoker, you know, the
so you got to get a buddy. You got to get a buddy.
Exactly.
To like, this is scientific now. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So I got to get a friend to bring his grill over and then we can cook 2 racks of ribs or 2, you know, chuck roasts or short rib, whatever, you know,
right.
Cook 2 hunks of the same meat at the same time, at the same temperature.
Right.
And
in
do
the same location.
Pecan and another with oak or, you know, one whatever. With cherry and another with apple or hickory or something. Yeah. And I mean, when you buy bags of wood at the grocery store, you see that they'll have recommended pairings. Some woods are better for chicken. Some woods are a little better for lamb. I mean, hickory is like the most intense wood, and I don't really use that for anything other than lamb or maybe sometimes chicken if I want a really smoky flavor on it. But if you use a milder fruit wood, like cherry, pecan, and apple are kind of the most common because you can smoke things for a really long time without the smoke flavor overpowering the food. You know, you don't want it to taste like a campfire.
No.
You just want it to have a little bit of extra something on it that was not cooked inside.
And that you can't really get from a normal oven or other various ways of cooking that same thing.
Yeah, you literally can't. You can approximate it. There's a thing called liquid smoke that's used in a lot of barbecue sauces,
cocktails.
And marinades. Cocktails, yeah. I mean, there are some incredible recipes with like sous vides and ovens where you can make ribs or brisket and have it taste like it's been smoked or close to it, but it's not exactly the same. I mean, if you think about what it's like when you sit around a campfire and then what your clothes smell like afterwards, there's nothing that replicates that other than burning wood and, you know, the aromatic compounds that it releases getting into your clothes, or in this case, your food.
Right. Do you know any of the science behind smoking, or?
Yeah, I know some of it. When I first started, so it's a pitch for not my website, but someone else's website, amazingribs.com. This guy, Meathead, is his moniker. I think his actual name is Craig Goldman. He used to be a sommelier for the Chicago Times, and he's been a food writer and a food critic, and now he runs this website and also has a New York Times bestselling cookbook called Meathead, the science of grilling or something. But it basically reads like a textbook where he lays out what happens to proteins when you hit them with different levels of energy. So heat is just energy. And if you're cooking with 500 or 700 degrees, there's more energy hitting the meat at one time. Basically, the most basic science is that when you cook the center of a piece of meat, it's not the heat that's cooking the meat. It's the outside of the meat that cooks the center. So the heat that you're using cooks the outside, and then the heat from the outside, you know, via osmosis or whatever, cooks the inside. Also, I mean, if you think about what happens to your body when you jump into a cold pool, that's basically what happens. I mean, it's a temperature shock, right? You're going from 70, 80 degree ambient air temperature to like a 40 degree pool.
Yeah.
That immediate shock is what causes your muscles to tense up.
Yeah.
And so that's what happens when you hit a piece of meat with really high heat coming from, again, you know, room temperature, 70 degrees or something. Mm-hmm. So with smoking, you hit that meat with a more gentle heat. And so the meat doesn't tense up. It, you know, stays relaxed. And then the most, like I said, basic, but here's more most basic sure. grilling info. So a steak, you want to cook it to about 135 degrees. Chicken, you want to cook it to about 160 degrees. Same with things like sausage or burgers, because that's a food safe temperature. That's the point where...
Yeah, this is all in Fahrenheit, just for any international listeners. Sorry.
Fahrenheit, yeah. Right. So 160 degrees Fahrenheit, or technically I think 165, is where all bacteria is pasteurized in 7 seconds. So when protein is at 165 degrees for 7 seconds, all the bacteria is dead, and that's why it's considered a food safe temperature. Mm-hmm. But for barbecue, there is a lot of connective tissue and, you know, so fat and tendons and things that if you eat it at a steak temperature, like 130, it's just going to be chewy. I mean, everyone, or maybe not everyone, but most people know the feeling of biting into gristle on the edge of a steak, and it just doesn't go anywhere. It's you're just chewing fat that you need to, you know, spit out or mm-hmm. whatever. That fat, if you cook it very slowly up to about 200 degrees Fahrenheit, the collagen turns into gelatin. And that's the process that you're aiming for with barbecue, is the conversion from collagen to gelatin, which then gives you that unbelievable, unctuous mouthfeel that you taste when you bite into ribs or brisket or something.
Right.
And the meat gets more and more tender and more flavorful, because fat is flavor.
Totally.
I mean, I love chicken, but it's the reason why a steak tastes a little richer than a chicken breast, or why like a chicken thigh tastes richer than a chicken breast. There's just more fat in it.
Right. Okay. That's really useful information, actually, because I knew some of it, but
not... Crash course.
Sorry?
The crash course, just the crash course of barbecue.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe this is a dumb question as well, but have you thought about doing any kind of Korean barbecue of any sort?
Yeah. I mean, I need to look into exactly, you know, I need to find a recipe and follow it and then like tweak it to my own tastes. Mm-hmm. But I love Korean barbecue, like bulgogi, mm-hmm. you know, the rice bowls with the beef. Mm-hmm. And oh my God, that stuff is incredible. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I basically need to get like some Korean cut short ribs or something like that, and figure out what type of marinades to use. I think they use soy-based marinades.
Or
I have not made any Korean barbecue. Yeah. Oh, totally.
Get that umami in there.
Green onions on top with some sesame seeds. Yeah, I've eaten quite a bit of Korean barbecue, and it is absolutely delicious, but I haven't cooked it myself yet. I've just done American Midwestern style barbecue so far.
Yeah.
Maybe some Texas barbecue for a brisket.
Sure. So what is your favorite thing so far to barbecue?
Well, ribs are a classic. I mean, when people think of barbecue, the first thing they think of is probably ribs. So I like those just because, I mean, they're great. Who doesn't love ribs? Short rib is one of the most interesting things to me. You can get it bone in or bone out. If you leave it in a larger steak cut, it's called a Denver steak or a zabuton. Short rib, you cook it for about 8 hours. And oftentimes people will do like a braised short rib and make a pasta out of it or something. But I like to just leave it on the smoker and let it go for 8 hours, develop a really thick bark. So one more delve into the science.
Sure.
When the meat starts cooking, it reaches a certain point somewhere between like 150 and 170 degrees Fahrenheit where evaporative cooling starts to take place. And so the moisture on the surface of the meat is cooling the meat at the same rate that your heat is heating the meat. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is the surface of the meat starts to dry out a little bit, which forms a bark. And that's, you know, when you bite into a piece of barbecue, the inside is tender and juicy and fatty, but the outside has that crunch with a little extra spice. You know, you taste all the flavorful rub or spice. Mm-hmm. And you get that crunchy texture on the outside, that's called a bark. And that's what happens, you know, like I said, between 150, 170 degrees. Short ribs, because it's such a small, blocky cut, you just get a really great bark to meat ratio. So in, you know, in one regular size serving of short rib, every bite will have bark on it. Mm-hmm. As opposed to with a brisket or something, there's a lot more internal meat, which is also great. But yeah, short rib, it's low maintenance. You don't have to mess with it too much. You put it on, keep the temperature stable, and then pull it off 8 hours later, and the flavor, they look like these little dark meteorites, just that textured blackened crust on the outside. Incredible. I think I'm gonna actually defrost some short ribs after we get off this call and cook them up maybe Tuesday or Wednesday.
Nice. Okay. And what are your favorite marinades to do, and how long do you marinate?
So I typically don't marinate for steaks, and I don't really marinate for barbecue, but I do like marinating chicken. I don't know that I could say that I have a favorite, but I'll typically just kind of throw whatever I've got in there. So, you know, get a big Ziploc bag and fill it with olive oil and some citrus, like a, you know, squeeze a lemon in there, salt, pepper. I'll go through my spice cabinet and just smell a few things and see what I want to add. Maybe like some thyme or rosemary. That's typically when you think of like roast chicken, mm-hmm. rosemary is a lot of that flavor. Mm-hmm. So I'll just, yeah, throw a bunch of different spices in there with olive oil and some citrus and let it marinate overnight, and then throw it on the, you know, charcoal grill with some smoking wood and give it that nice charred, you know, surface with, you know, a little bit of smoke flavor. Yeah. So I don't have a really definitive answer for
marinades. There's no Brendan's yet, marinade or anything like that.
No, no. It's all, yeah, when people ask me what I use to marinate, I'd say, I don't know. Like I didn't measure it. I have to do more dishes if I measure it.
Sure.
So right? I just kind of dump in some olive oil, squeeze a, you know, lemon or lime in there. Yeah. I know some people who really like doing orange juice in their marinades. So use like orange juice with olive oil and let the citrus tenderize the meat overnight. Mm-hmm. I will say one thing. So it's not a marinade, but something that I found out on the, you know, again, this website, amazingribs.com, is the science of salt. Salt works as an enzyme that tenderizes meat and helps make it, I mean, first of all, more flavorful, but over time, more juicy, and also lets the surface of the meat dry out. So you get a better bark or a better crust, like on a steak or chicken or something. And so I started dry brining all of my meat, mm-hmm. which is, you basically just apply salt to the meat 4 to 24 hours ahead of time and just stick it in the fridge uncovered and let the salt. What happens is the salt sits on the surface, water from inside the meat gets pulled out to the surface, the salt dissolves in that water, and then that water gets reabsorbed into the center of the meat where it starts tenderizing the muscle fibers. And that's something I do with every single cut of meat I make now, whether it's chicken, pork, beef. I don't really dry brine fish, but all the land-based meats get a healthy dry brine before I cook them.
It's like taking a bath, right? Similar to using Epsom salts or something.
Oh, I guess so.
We don't like completely dry out and then rehydrate ourselves, but like something about that, the salts relaxes our muscles in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also, I mean, you can do a wet brine where it's literally salt water. You give your meat a salt water bath.
Or if you want to do the salt, fat, acid, heat way of buttermilk.
It's like, yeah. Like the buttermilk chicken brine from Samin.
I did that this past Christmas, and it came out I was blown away. I didn't think it was going to be that good, you know. But I baked it. Mm-hmm. I didn't smoke it. Like I dumped the chicken in there, and I just buttermilk plus salt equals a lovely combination of things.
I remember hearing about that recipe a couple months ago from one of my friends who I actually trade a lot of grilling information and also like pictures of our projects. He told me about this recipe and said, "Dude, this is the best chicken I've ever had in my life."
Yeah, it's astoundingly good. And if you have the patience and the room in your refrigerator, it's like that's what you do, you know. Do you have like an Instagram that you post? Are you like trying to do that kind of thing? Or
I do have an Instagram. I'm not trying to monetize it or, you know, gain a large amount of followers or anything. But if anyone wants to see some of the cooking projects that I do, it's BBQ Bassist.
Nice. Okay, well, you've got my entire mouth salivating. That sounds so delicious. I wish whenever I am able to come down to St. Louis, I'll let you know, and hopefully you'll treat me to some of your barbecue.
I will. That's another thing that's been so fun about is that whenever friends come to visit, I can cook them something that I'm really proud of and invested in, rather than, you know, scratching my head like, oh, what do I serve this person?
Yeah, right.
I hope I can come up with something tasty. You know, now I know that I can come up with something tasty that not everyone has access to. You know, mm-hmm. you need like a big porch or a backyard or something. You know, not everyone has a grill. And since I'm lucky enough to have one, I love getting to share that magic with people.
Yeah. And I'm sure everyone is highly appreciative of that. No, not one person is going to be
like... Me, most
of
all. My own stomach.
Yes.
More than anybody else.
All right. Can I ask you two final questions?
Of course.
What is one piece of advice you would tell your younger self about entering and pursuing a music career?
Oh, man. This is going to sound so unbelievably played out and cliche, but practice scales and arpeggios. It's so true.
Yeah.
It really is the truth.
Yeah. Every time you take your instrument out.
And also, okay, so that's, you know, everyone has heard that from their teacher and no one likes to hear it. So if there's one other thing, I would just say stay as open as possible to new experiences. Play for as many people as you can. Ask as many questions as you can. I think that's maybe the thing that helped me most in my growth is I was just constantly picking other people's brains about how they thought about music or, you know, what type of practice techniques they would use or what things they thought I needed to adjust in my playing. You will always get something from playing for someone else, even if you don't feel ready. A lot of people I've seen fall into the trap of just saying, well, I just need to practice more. I'm not ready to play for anyone. Mm-hmm. And I think that even if you're quote unquote not ready to play for someone, you can still learn something, whether it's a piece of advice or, you know, a piece of feedback they give you, or just to see how you perform under pressure. Sometimes you're more prepared than you think you are on something. And sometimes something that feels really in the pocket goes totally out the window, and so it gives you just more information about what's going to happen when you're nervous.
Mm-hmm. That's really good advice. I actually was thinking, as you were talking about that, I was thinking about this is almost more like a life mantra, but we're always a work in progress. So the idea of that you are ready or not ready, well, I mean, it's just on a day-to-day of work in progress of the day. And some of those is, I guess, more marinated than others or something, but...
Always, yeah. I've taken auditions where I felt more prepared than others, but I have never, and I don't think any musician will ever say, oh yeah, that day that I played, I was as prepared as I could possibly be. Mm-hmm. You know, I played absolutely perfectly. That's the best it's ever going to get for me.
Yeah.
I just don't think that exists. There's always work to be done and growth to be made and, you know, something more you can say, something deeper that you can pull out of the music with more time, you know, and that's why some of the finest musicians out there are the ones who just have an unbelievable wealth of performance experience. You can be a young hotshot virtuoso, but having the life experiences to put into the music after 20, 30, 50 years, it's like a well-seasoned piece of meat.
Yeah, I know. There's so many connections back. Okay. And as we enter a whatever pandemic world we're experiencing, what elements of your musical pandemic life would you want to continue and what would you want to shed?
The thing that I would want to continue is playing more solo Bach. There were long periods of time when I wasn't working with the symphony during the, you know, first stages of the pandemic, where if I picked up my bass, I would just play Bach. and that's it. And I definitely want to keep that. As far as things I'd like to shed, I would say the general lack of organization that I fell into during some of those same periods. You know, I didn't feel like I needed to learn a certain amount of pieces every week. I didn't follow my own advice about practicing scales and arpeggios every day. You're only going to get better by being more organized and more thoughtful and diligent with how you structure your time.
Yeah.
Or my time.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there any platforms or websites for our listeners to learn more about you or any upcoming projects?
Well, my artist bio is on the St. Louis Symphony website, and I think there's links to some of our concert rebroadcasts there. Other than that, I mean, I mostly just post barbecue content on my Instagram, BBQ Bassist. And I think there may be a clip or two of me playing something there. And there may be more in the future. I actually, for the first time, went on Instagram Live about maybe a week before a Philadelphia Orchestra audition back in December, and I got really nervous really fast, and then I was able to watch the video later and see, you know, like I just talked about, like what held up under pressure.
Yeah.
And ultimately it was fun. You know, you play a piece of Bach or you play an excerpt, and then you lean down and look at the chat and see what your friends are saying. So I may do some of that in the future.
Sounds good. All right. And if you enjoyed listening, be sure to smash that subscribe button wherever you're tuning into this podcast. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts while you're at it. It doesn't need to be long. Your review will help others search for the podcast because of the crazy algorithms, and you'll make Sushi's day, and it's free. Make sure to share this podcast with your friends and family as well. If you want to level up, you can always become part of the Hidden Behind the Music Stand family by donating what you will on our Patreon page at patreon.com/hidenmusicstand. Our social media handle for Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter is at Hidden Music Stand, and we'd love to hear from you at our email, hidenmusicstand@gmail.com. Didn't recognize a piece we discussed during the episode? No worries! There's a Spotify playlist with all the music discussed for your convenience. The link is in the description of each episode. Brendan, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your wisdom of food and how it's best cooked or smoked, let's put it, and also just your overall story of how you came to be the musician and person that you are today.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun to talk to you. I love, you know, just sharing stuff about music and life and food. I mean, that's what it's about. Life is music and food.
Yeah, that's our lives at least. Yeah. Let's keep it that way. And thanks for listening. Say bye, Sushi.